So I now invite Amy Klin, our meeting chair, to come to present the Lifetime Achievement Award.
Well, it's really an immense personal pleasure and a professional honor to introduce Dr. Fred Volkmar, a longtime friend who is now awarded the Life Achievement Award by MFAR, by NSAR. Introducing Fred in 3 minutes or less is going to be extremely challenging. But Fred is the director of the Yale Child Study Center. He is the Irving B. Harris Professor of Child Psychiatry, Psychiatry, Pediatric Psychology at Yale University School of Medicine, and Chief of Child Psychiatry at Yale New Haven Hospital. I had the pleasure and honor to learn from Fred for over 20 years. I think we've aged together, and now we're looking so much better. Fred's career has had some ups and downs. Well, ups, he is the author, editor of 21 books and monographs. And some of those books are books that many generations now have been socialized in and have learned about autism. The downs. Fred never made it to the Navy SEALs. I looked for 2.5 hours for this photograph in which I saw Fred in full snorkel regalia, 2001, Martha's Vineyard, and that's an image that is etched in my mind. And since I don't have the photograph, I simply had to put there a placeholder. So Fred was born in Southern Illinois. Here are his parents, and now we know where he gets his good looks. That smile in the middle there, I've seen many, 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 many times, and apparently he was a little bit of a ladies' man. And here is Find Fred in his school. Can you? I give you 5 seconds. Lucy, Emily, I think you know that photograph. Well, there he is. Fred went on. High school was kind of boring, and Fred really seemed to be spinning wheels. So here is Fred on his way to the International Science Fair with little mice there, a little Pavlovian. Cancer susceptibility in mice. Fred, this is you're a senior in high school. Come on. On to college and nice hairdo, Fred. So he went to University of Illinois, Urbana, and progress was really, really, really slow. So that's a little publication there. Is that science? I think it was. So this is, Fred's first publication was in Science. So that was an exuberant career. On to Stanford, and 9 papers later, now he had degrees in medicine and in psychology, and now Fred was also a psychiatrist. And I tell you, 9 papers, but it was all over the place. Behavioral neuroscience, experimental psychology, the impact of social cultural experiences on language, already psychopharmacology. So this was really a very expansive and exuberant start for a career. But then he went on, and he arrived at the world-renowned and beloved Yale Child Study Center. So Dr. Arnold Gazell was a pediatrician and the first child psychologist in this country. And he founded the Yale Child Study Center in 1911. But most importantly, he infused a respect for development, for human development. And Fred has become not only a psychiatrist and a psychologist, but a true developmentalist. And then there are those people, Al Sonnet, one of the giants of the field of really child advocacy. And of course, Donald Cohen. So Donald Cohen was the very first Life Achievement Award of NSAR back in 2001. Donald influenced Fred deeply, as well as many, many, many generations in this field. So these are pioneers, luminaries, really intellectual giants. The rest is history. I think I don't need to introduce you to all of Fred's accomplishments over the past many, many years. I don't think that there was any set of practice parameters that Fred was not involved in every single relevant professional organization. He was in state, national, international council societies. He was there when long-stay hospitals were being closed. He was in every editorial board that I know of is relevant to this field, and he's been carrying the banner of the Journal of Autism and Developmental Disorders for many, many, many years. Many awards, many grants, many hundreds of papers, and talking about disseminating knowledge, talking about carrying this message to people out there, the community, not only the professionals, but everywhere, everywhere, people who have an impact on individuals with autism and their families, over 600 presentations. And of course, he mentored several generations of leaders in the field. So Fred has had an enormous impact on the field of child psychiatry and allied disciplines, but for those of us who really know Fred and who have been there in the trenches with him, I can tell you that probably the most important legacy, the most important contribution of Fred to this field has been his contribution to thousands of children and families. Children and families who came to the Yale Child Study Center, and he put his heart out there for them and was among the most strongest advocates that I've ever seen in action in my life. So there he was, conquering this condition, one child and one family at a time. So I want to congratulate Fred, but I also want to congratulate those that took the prize. So Dr. Lisa Wisner, a pediatrician, and of course, the lovely Lucy and Emily, who now have so amazing accomplishments in their own rights. So here we are, Dr. Fred Volkmar, an immense pleasure for us to introduce you. Thank you.
That was wonderful. Oh, I think it's a gizmo. Ami, come up to the gizmo. Thank you. Thank you very much. The gizmo's a big thing. Oh, Lordy, thank you very much. So I've got to remember which button to push. Okay, so the usual model, as far as I can tell, for talks like this is it's like a sandwich. You thank people, and then we have a little bit of a talk, and then you thank people again, and you're done. In fact, I want to try to do it, and the title of my talk alludes a bit to this, which is to tell a bit more of a story, and you heard part of the story already, and we're actually, amazingly, without coordinating, we're actually well coordinated today. I want to give you some background, both in terms of me, but also interacting research and clinical work, which I think has been very important and one of the main things I learned from Donald Cohen. I'm going to talk a little bit about me, talk some about the current state of work and what I see as some of the needs for the future, and partly give you my perspective as somebody who's been in the field for about 30 years now, but also as a person who's edited the Journal of Autism and who has seen every conceivable paper you can possibly imagine. Come through. And then a little bit more thanks, and then a story to close, which is an inspiring story, best kind of story. So I want to start with this. I'm actually on a committee for the federal government working at the Institute of Medicine to redo the guidelines for Social Security disability income for children with disabilities, if you follow all that. So February, any of those of you who lived in the East Coast of the United States, remember, there were a few snowstorms this year. So February, there's a blizzard. And the next day, I'm supposed to be in D.C. working on this committee. So I call them. In the meantime, I hear, the federal government has closed, right? And they say, no, come ahead. So I get on the Acela from New Haven. The train stops twice. The guy gets out with the conductor with his light to check that the tracks are safe, right? It's just a craziness. It's like the murder on the Orient Express. I get to D.C. There's no taxis at the train station, because the whole city, as you know, one snowflake happens, the city closed down. This is 6 inches, right? You have to pay $25 just to get into a cab. So I suck it up, pay my $25, get to the hotel. The next morning, there's no cabs, because it's such a mess, and I have to take the Red Line, which is about 4 blocks away. And so I huff it through the snow and the ice, slipping and sliding, to get to DuPont Circle, to take the Red Line. You're going to see I'm going to come to the point momentarily. So I have a patient who knew I wasn't seeing him that particular week. I don't see him every week, but I see him every couple of weeks. And he knew I couldn't see him, and he always wants to know where I'm going. And I said I was going to DC. And the reason this is important is he follows the subways. So I get to the Red Line station, I buy my ticket, I'm there, the door is open, the train is jam-packed, it's like sardines in a can. I push my way in the train, the door is shut, and I get a text. And the text is from my patient, it says, Dr. Volkmer, don't take the Red Line. And by God, 30 seconds later, the train stops, dead in the water, and there was a disabled train further down the path. So I texted him back and said, whoops, too late. But to speak to the issue of thinking about abilities and not just disabilities, but also the fact that he's somebody who was really worried about me, and he was trying to think of how could he, you know, take care of me. And so he's busy monitoring, you know, the subway. So I think one of the lessons from this is to really listen to our patients and to understand what their special abilities are and try to use them as we can as a way to make connections and have really lifelines to people. So let me say a little bit about Leo Kanner, obviously the giant in our field. He's the person who really posed us two riddles. Why is it that children with autism seem to be so socially isolated, they have trouble processing social information, especially early on in their life? At the same time, they're so attuned to the non-social world. They don't like change. They get interested in other things that are less social but more animated. What's this all about? And that's a puzzle we're still trying to sort out. And I think it's a tribute to the field that we are still trying to sort it out, but it's, of course, especially a tribute to Leo Kanner. Oh, it's stuck. Where's Brendan? Okay, look, we got it to go. I got to go on my own, Brendan. So some paradoxes. Autism once was thought to be very rare. As you heard just a few minutes ago, autism is now thought to be rather common. Early on, there was confusion with childhood schizophrenia. We now actually think childhood schizophrenia is really remarkably rare. There was early emphasis by Leo Kanner on developmental issues, but in point of fact, early on in my career, which started in 1980 with Donald Cohen at Yale, to see a 4 or 5-year-old child with autism was to see a very young child. And so it's interesting that, in fact, now we have a big focus on younger children, and in fact have more or less not so much focused on older individuals where much of the action is at. And as people know, there are the recurrent diagnostic tensions, the tidal waves back and forth of the DSMs, the lumping and splitting tension. At the moment, we're lumping. In the past, we've split, and we'll probably come back to some splitting again. And a big problem of comorbidity, which we still don't do a great job of dealing with and understanding. Having a diagnosis like autism, you can pick up other problems. As we're now looking at our older individuals, our more cognitively advanced individuals, we're aware of problems with anxiety and depression and other things. So my interest in autism, actually, it started back in 1978 when I volunteered at, I think it was called the Lincoln School in Lincoln, Illinois. It was a residential school, and there were a couple children there with autism, and I was fascinated. I went to work with a man named Joe Hunt. Joe Hunt had been the president of the American Psychological Association. He had not taught undergraduates in 30 years, and I, in my ignorance, as somebody from a town of about 600 people, and here I was at this humongous university, there were more psychology majors than people that lived in my town. Right? 6,000 psychology majors. My town was 600. And in my ignorance, having taken psychology and loved it, I went to talk to Joe Hunt, who, as I say, was a distinguished professor, which meant he never had to interact with undergraduates. And he actually started, God love him, an advanced psychology course in developmental on Piaget. And I took that class, and then I think as either a sophomore or as a junior, I became the teaching fellow for the class. And got to know through him a lovely man named William T. Greeno. I think I was Bill Greeno's first student at the University of Illinois. He was a new psychology professor, and I was interested in the effects of experience on the brain. And so I did a study looking at rats and environmental complexity and did dendritic branching. And God love Bill Greeno. He let me be first author in a paper. And as you heard from Ami, the paper appeared in Science. And I'm sure that's what got me into Stanford, actually. One of my best friends, my truly best friend in the world, I met at Stanford. He was a fellow medical student. And I remember the first week I was there, I was at this horrible mixer. And if you're ever in medical school at Stanford, you will discover, I'm sure it's the same thing at Yale Medical School, about 25% of the kids are from Berkeley, 25% are from Stanford, 25% are from Harvard, and 25% are Yale. And other than minority candidates, I was the only person that had gone to a state school. And I can remember the guy who became my best friend. I heard him over talk. He went to Yale, and he was talking to some other Yalie. And the other Yalie was saying, what the hell is this guy doing here from the University of Illinois? How did he get in? And my friend-to-be, Larry, looks at him and said, don't you realize he's got to be wicked smart to get in here? So that was my introduction to Stanford. And it's interesting, I worked with a woman named Alberta Siegel, who was the first tenure professor in the medical school, and also with a wonderful man named Mickey Stunkert, and then moved on from there to Yale. And you saw some of the pictures that Ami showed of Al Salmet, Ed Ziegler, Sam Ritvo, Sally Province. Sam and Sally actually wrote the first paper on imitation in autism back in 1950. A wonderful woman named Sarah Sparrow, who taught many of us much of what we know about assessment methods and the difference that even a few IQ points make. And finally, Donald Cohen, who was really a giant in the field and who was committed to taking care of families, but also of research, and really trying as much as he could to integrate research and clinical training. Let me say a little bit about what's happened in terms of our understanding of autism over time. By the 50s and 60s, autism was around. People sort of knew about it, but they blamed it on the parents. Remember this, the refrigerator mother business. By the 1970s, we started to get some very nice research. We saw for the first time that there were high rates of seizure disorders in classically autistic children. This was very strong brain basis of autism. We also realized with the Fulstein and Rutter papers that there was a strong genetic contribution. And finally, papers started to come out to say that behavioral methods, structured behavioral teaching, was much better than just letting the child be on their own. By the 1980s, and keep this in mind because I'm going to come back to it in just a second, we had official recognition in DSM for the first time. With this increased awareness, we had more research and treatment programs, and again, there was much more work on teaching, showing that structured teaching was eminently more successful than just letting the child go on their own devices. By the 1990s, research increased, as did programs, many of them started by parents. We also had the beginning of an increase in support for research and a range of programs around the country that really often were early on center-based, but gradually over time morphed. From 2000 to present, we've had a literal explosion of research. I'm going to show you just one second, especially in genetics, neuroscience, and with young children. I'm going to talk a little bit about where we don't have so much research. That 2001 report from the National Research Council that Kathy Lord chaired, and I was on, along with a number of other people, some of whom were in the room, was really a landmark, because we were asked by the Department of Education of the United States, does educating make a difference in autism? And the answer was yes. And at that point, there were 10 evidence-based programs that could show they really made a difference. And they made a significant difference indeed. From 2000 to present, we've had much more active advocacy. Parents have gotten out there. They've been really swinging at it with legislators, with other people, with schools. The increased parent support groups and foundations and public awareness has been fantastic. Also, we've had a growing body of work on interventions so that we now have more evidence-based interventions than we used to. And as Ami alluded to, we've had a number of people issue practice guidelines. So the pediatric neurologists were early on about screening. The child psychiatrist, and I was the author back in 2000, had the first practice guidelines from child psychiatry. Those were just revised. There's a whole set of practice guidelines in Europe that are fantastic. Ian McClure has been very involved along with others, the NICE guidelines. There's also been, I think, a very strong emphasis on screening and early diagnosis. And I think that's fantastic. At the same time, there sadly has been a tendency to overlook older children, adolescents, and adults. And I can tell you that just sort of scanning the papers that come through JAD, I'm always interested to see papers that are concerned with older individuals of all levels of functioning. So research has increased both in terms of sheer volume, papers, and sophistication of studies. We now have a number of journals that are devoted to this in the field. I want to do a very quick overview of looking at research productivity. If you look, and this, the data are from, I think this is from Medline, you get slightly different results if you use different search engines. But this is grouping paper by 5 years blocks. This is the number of papers that appeared. And you can see by 1980, between 75 and 80, we had, maybe 600 papers. After 1980, when autism was recognized, we start to see a shoot up. This next slide is by year. So this shows you that as of 2012, we were close to 2,500 peer-reviewed scientific papers a year. I haven't been able to quite settle on the 2013 data yet. But this means you're going to have to read about 6 papers a day if you want to keep up with everything in the field, which is both impossible but also fantastic. it means there's been so much productivity that we're really, you know, we're just churning it out all the time, and that's great. Except if you're a journal editor and have to cope with it. So the Journal of Autism and Developmental Disorders, and I'm very pleased Judy Jones and Bill from Springer, both of them are here today. These are the editors of JAD over time, starting with Lee O'Connor back in 1971, then with the wonderful Eric Schopler, and of course with Professor Sir Michael Rutter, then Gary Mezeboff, and me more recently. JAD has been a tremendously interesting task for me to undertake, and I'm infinitely grateful to Springer for really being supportive, and let me treat this as a very serious scientific problem and a real peer-reviewed journal, that there's never any interference from the publisher, which is fantastic. At the same time, the good and the bad news. In 1998, there were about 300 papers submitted. Last year, 840 papers submitted. We're going to get over 900 papers this year. That again, it's both a testament and also a bit of a problem, but it's fantastic that the volume has increased. I want to take this instant to thank everybody who reviews, and I want to remind people who are always sending in papers but never review that I'm on you. I'm going to start to call people out. I have one person in particular. I'm waiting for her to send in a paper. She's always sending in papers, and 57 times I've asked that lady to review, and 56 times she has said no. So I'm just going to share that dilemma with her the next time she submits. So I want to set up a little bit about what we know very briefly. And I realize you think that you might be a challenging audience, and I got to tell you, you're not such a challenging audience. I'm going to show you a scary audience. You ready? This is 50 Boy Scouts in Wallingford, Connecticut. Now think about, you got 10 minutes to explain to them what autism is about, and then an hour for them to ask questions. So I'll show you scary. But it's interesting, and I got invited, and I was delighted to go, partly because they had had a child with Asperger's who had not been successfully included in the group. And the scoutmaster felt badly about that, as did some of the scouts. And I said, sure, I'll come out and give you a talk. And so I did. So you're going to get the slightly abbreviated version of the Boy Scout talk. I wanted to explain to them a couple of take-home messages, that autism is, at least at first blush, a hidden disability, that it's not something when you initially look at the person, you realize they have autism, that you can think about it as a social learning disability. I talked to them a little bit about genetics and the social brain and about outcome, but also in terms of strategies that we can use to help people with autism when they're trying to interact and need appropriate and helpful feedback. There have been a lot of work on the brain. People like David, who've been very involved in this, know we have an explosion of work in terms of understanding how the brain works. I'm going to try to give you some of the highlights from our own research in terms of thinking about some of the mechanisms of the social brain, but there's just been an explosion of work in this area over the last decade. We also know, as you heard, that the genetics of autism is very interesting and extremely complicated. And I took this slide from, I think it's one of the Emory websites. This just shows the apparent, at the moment, genetic forms of autism. This is very interesting. It's also extremely complicated. And so one of our tasks for the next decade is to try to sort all this out in more meaningful ways and get it back to thinking about mechanisms. Now, what do we understand about autism? And this is one of the slides I showed to the Boy Scouts, because often they would have seen this movie. Autism is first and foremost a disorder of social interaction associated with unusual patterns of learning and often an over-engagement in the non-social world. So put it, and again, this is time trying to explain this to the Boy Scouts. If you're a social person, you have a social frame, you're a people person. You take your lead from looking at others, what they're looking at, what they're feeling from their face, how they're responding. How should you respond? You become very good at multitasking. Organizational skills are needed because so much of social interaction is complicated and it's ongoing. So that by the time you're a year or so of age, you're very adept at the social world. You're playing the social game constantly. Put it another way, if you come into the social world, like most of us with a social frame, people are at the center of your universe. You get the development of things like joint attention, emotional development, a desire to communicate because that's so much more effective. People become the most important thing, starting with the parents. If you don't have that, and thank God St. Isidore is with us, our GIF file is working, you get interested in the non-social world. You fail in terms of your social orientation. You seek meaning, of course, all of us seek meaning, but you're looking at that through the environment. You're looking through a different frame. You're trying to look at meaning through consistency, stability, contingency. As a result, you're having a gestalt learning style, and you have difficulties in multitasking, many of the things we think about as very characteristic of autism. We know that most of us are very attracted to faces. In the typical baby, from the very beginning of life, I remember holding my older daughter, who had come out after a long labor in a C-section, and then she would whisk off to the newborn nursery because my wife's a pediatrician, and they were all freaked out. And I went over to, having been sure that my wife was okay, I went over to see my newborn baby, who's this big kid, 10 pounds, surrounded by these little babies. And I hold her, she's looking at me, I'm looking at her, and we're off and running however many 27 years later. But that's how it's supposed to happen. We also see that in adults, I'm going to show you something in a second, to see what you sort of see in a very interesting slide. We also know, this is the work of Jamie, and I think Jerry was here, and others, that we have characteristic responses when we look at faces, EEG and MRI responses. So you may see, here's a wave, and what do you see? Right? We're programmed to see faces. So if we look at this wave, we think, oh, that's a face. And again, we know from the literature on autism that people with autism don't do so well in norm facial recognition tasks. They seem to do better looking at inverted faces than most of us do. This is something that for most of us stops at around 6 months. At 6 months, we get much better looking at right side up faces. And they also seem to rely less on the most salient features and things that most of us would consider extraneous, as a person wearing a hat or not a hat. This is all work that's been done using still faces. This is a study we did some years ago. Bob Schultz, who couldn't be here because his wife is graduating, I think, from business school literally today. This is now something I think Bob would tell me probably even greater times, but this was the first time we showed it, and it's been now replicated 20 times. And we showed that for looking at faces over objects, we got different patterns of activation in that facial recognition area of the fusiform gyrus. And here you see my other daughter, Emily, along with what was then, who was then, a Yale undergraduate student taking my class, which I'm going to come back to talk about. This was a Yale undergraduate thesis. This is Warren Jones and the $20,000 baseball hat, the donors of whom are in the audience today. We wanted to look at the world in a new way to see what people looked at when they actually looked at social stimuli. We used this lovely set of very short clips from Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, and amazingly enough, discovered both in our first paper and then looking at groups of people, very significant differences in the way people with autism, high-functioning autism, looked at the world. We have ongoing work at Yale. I just want to acknowledge very quickly my colleagues, Kevin Pelfrey, who does the most amazingly interesting MRI, fMRI studies, along with Brent Vanderwijk, and I mentioned Jamie, who does EEG. We're also looking at oxytocin effects. Kasia Havarska, who's sitting right here in the front row, along with Fred Schick, we're looking at face processing in high-risk infants. We're also looking at ways to support through technology. My colleague Pam Ventola is looking at the effects of pivotal response training on the brain and development and neurocorrelates, and Dennis Sukodalski, who I think may be here, is looking at parent management training. So we continue to have a very active group. Let me say a little bit about where the gaps are. Intervention research, especially for older individuals, is a real problem in terms of its lack. There's very, very, very limited work on aging. Pat Hallin, who's a former winner of this prize and is in the audience, knows that most of us, we seem to stop our studies at young adulthood. That's it, it's done. Well, amazingly enough, those of us who are in our 50s and 60s realize development continues to happen. And it really is a shame that we don't have more information on aging and autism. It's something that we really critically need. Also, the evidence base for treatments is highly variable in terms of the nature of the discipline, but also in terms of the nature of the methods used, and especially the age of the sample. We're often generalizing things from little children or school-age children to adolescents and adults, and we don't have enough evidence. We really need to think about better approaches. We need better metrics. You heard about subtyping of the broader autism phenotype. We need to think in new ways, and we also need to think about new approaches to early diagnosis. Now, this is an interesting slide, and I apologize, I didn't have time to update it to the present. You can sort of see the gray bars, I think. You probably see them better than I do. This just shows papers published in autism, but the black bars show autism in treatment. And so the bottom line is that although we're doing a great job of getting papers out there, treatment studies are very hard to get funded. As somebody who sits periodically on study sections, I can tell you, a treatment study is always going to have a flaw. It's like a good oriental carpet. There's always going to be something wrong with it. And somebody in that study section is going to focus on that one thing that's wrong with it. Oh, you used the wrong measure, or you didn't use this metric, or you failed to acknowledge my seminal work in the year. And all it needs, you think I'm making this up, but I'm not. All it needs is one person to be very negative, and that kills your intervention study. That's why I think some of the most successful efforts at the federal level have been through some of the mechanisms like ACE and CPA and the START, to really force folks to collaborate on studies through things like the RUP psychopharm that we've been involved in over the years. And it sort of bypasses this problem of getting good quality research funded. Social policy issues. One of the things, and Peter Doering's just published a wonderful book on autism across America, we have 50 experiments going on in the 50 states. Nobody is looking at that, including the blasted federal government, which ought to be. In my state, we have experiments from town to town. Every town is different. And we should try to make sense of that in terms of thinking about what models work, what models don't. And Peter's new book actually talks some about this, but it's limited in terms of what he's covering. I do think there's a critical need, and I give my colleagues from Great Britain real points for this, that at least in reviewing grants from Britain, there's always a little section about how does this translate into the world of parents and families and children. And I think we don't do quite as enough about that as we should here in the States. We have high quality work, we're putting out all this research. Let's take a step back and say, how does this apply to children and families? How can we make this applicable? How can we make this real? Now, you can't always do that, but when you can, shouldn't we be doing it? Last week, people, at least, and you can check it again, if you typed the word autism into Google, you got over 25 million hits. If you're a parent newly diagnosed with a child, what are you supposed to do with that? How do you find quality researchers? There's a couple of papers now in JAD and other places looking at the top 100 websites. About a third of them are either selling something or promising you a cure. So again, we need to think about how can we get quality information out there to parents, and we really have been trying over the last few years. So I want to thank a wonderful group of students and collaborators. You heard from Ami. I started to put together a list from my CV, and I was going to have a list of names. I thought, oh, this is going to really be boring. So I didn't do that, but I want to thank all my students. I've had a lot of wonderful students over the years, but also the patients and families. We have seen since 1980 about 7,000 children. And one of the things I'm hoping to do before I really head to retirement is to try to do a follow-up study to see what's happened to some of these people, many of whom are now in their 50s and 60s and 70s, and some of whom I hear from on a very regular basis. I want to thank the Simons Foundation, the Hillebrands Autism Speaks, the Rosens, also my colleagues who I think usually don't want to be acknowledged, but who are sitting in the second row, and who funded our original eye tracking study, the Associates of the Child Study Center, and also NICHD and NIMH. I'm right, you don't want to be acknowledged, right? No, okay, you didn't want to be, I thought probably not, but I checked. So a quick story to end. So this is upbeat, you ready? So for the last 30 years, I've had a course in Yale College. This is Yale College. Not the medical school, the college. So this is very special. It's like joining the Masons to get a course in Yale College. And you go through a lot of hoops. And I've done this, originally with Nancy Moss as a co-instructor for many years with Ami once he was in the faculty, more recently with Jamie McPartland. It's an interesting course. We have the students come in, they have a seminar every week of about 90 minutes, and they go out and work 3 or 4 hours a week either in a school for lower functioning, more challenging individuals, Ben Haven, or more recently at Chapel Haven, which has a program for kids in high school on the cusp of being able to go to college, but who need a little extra help. So a very different population, and a small number, maybe 3 or 4, will come and see patients with us in the clinic every week. So it's different experiences, but it's a chance to see kind of at least one person, sometimes many people, on the autism spectrum. And so then they have that and the seminar. Now, the interesting thing about this, I'll mention the videos. A couple of years ago, the secretary of the university gave a talk at the medical school at the dean's lunch about autism on the web, and I thought this was going to be really painful because I was not expecting much. I say that as a Stanford graduate, but also a University of Illinois, both of them had great computer science programs. And in fact, it was wonderful, and I went up to her later and told her that I was really happy to see this, and they were getting stuff out there. You know, Yale's been collecting stuff for 300 years. They want to get out. They've got box, 2- and 3-part inventions in his own hand with his corrections. They want to get that out there. That's great. But they want to get intellectual content out there. And they showed they're using courses that they fill and they put on the web from around the world. And so I went up to her and I said, this was wonderful. You know, we've been doing this course in Yale College on autism. And she said, oh, autism, there's a lot of interest. So we filmed these lectures. There's 15 lectures. It's, if you go to YouTube or iTunes U and type in Yale and Autism, up pop 15 college-level lectures, perfectly free. You can use them as you like. Just don't modify them because Yale's got a lot of lawyers. But this has been fantastic, and we've had, I think, over 200,000 views. Now, who knows what that means? But 200,000 people around the world at some point have clicked into one of these lectures, which is fantastic. And it's not just me and Jamie holding forth. It's people like Matt Stay. It's people like Ami, Akasha. We're really trying to do a good job of covering the range of autism. And the course this semester was especially interesting because we had our first day, we have shopping period. We had 60 kids show up. We can't take 60 kids. We can take about 20 or 25. So the kids have to write a little essay, why I want to take this course. And so then the teaching fellow reads all these essays, and she'll send me a list of who should get first preference. And I say, here's the principle, seniors first, and then juniors, and then sophomores, and then freshmen. But if somebody, and we tell the kids to tell us where they're at in school, what college, why they're interested in taking the course, et cetera, et cetera. And I say, if anybody mentions they're a sibling, you take them. I don't care whatever else is true, you take them. So we got two siblings in the class this year, both of whom were fantastic. We actually, in both cases, know the sibs of the sibs. And in one case, one of the siblings of the sibling of the sibling took the class a few years ago. So it was a very interesting class, and we had Ben Carey from the New York Times came and talked to the class about reporting on autism. We had a guy who took the class about 15, 20 years ago, who went to Wall Street, made his fortune, retired at 42, and is now taking care of his older brother with autism. He came and talked about the sibling experience. So it was just a wonderful class and a wonderful experience. I think the kids had a great time. But so the interesting thing, so a personal first this year. So the teaching fellow is reading these things, and she says, okay, I've got the list. Here's the seniors, here's the juniors. There's two siblings. They're both, one's a freshman, one's a sophomore. I'll take them. But I want you to read this other essay, Dr. Voltmer. So I read this essay, and it starts out, my name is such and such. I have been a sophomore at Yale. I'm at such and such a college. The reason I want to take this class is I have autism, and I've not disclosed it, and I want to understand more about it. In 30 years, that's the first time that's ever happened. And that is fantastic. And it's a tribute to the field. It's obviously a tribute to the individual, his family. And as I've gotten to know him, it's interesting, and there's no question in my mind, and again, I emphasize I'm his teacher, not his doc, but you know, this is a true thing. And again, that's just a wonderful commentary on what has happened in the field over the last 30 years. So very quickly, let me thank my wife, who's been patient and long-suffering, and I think who would agree, when we got into this, we said, okay, we're going to do it 50-50, and by God, I think we did. And so that's great. And let me also thank my kids who are here. And as you'll see, we are somewhat of a dog family. And speaking of which, now where's Brendan? Because I'm going to screw this up. You know I'm going to screw this up, right, Brendan? This is the one that gave us the most trouble, but my good friend Brendan's going to come. He's going to make this happen. I'm sorry to put you on the spot, Brendan, but you know damn well I'll screw it up. No, if you screw it up, then I can yell at you. Okay, you ready? Brendan's going to do it. Okay, so I'm ending with a bulldog, and I hope I didn't put you to sleep. Thanks, Brendan.